Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
The kids on Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
Halloweenies, a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
From the Consequence Podcast Network, the minds behind The Losers Club, comes a new podcast in fantasy terror.
Nancy, there's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Halloweenies, a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Consequence Podcast Network.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you wanna make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Greetings, Constant listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast presented by the Consequence Podcast Network. I'm your host, Editor-in-Chief Michael Rothman, and if you listen closely, you can hear the gentle orchestra of the cicadas singing their last summer songs as the season comes to an end. But so is our time in Derry, as this week's episode marks the finale of our coverage of It Chapter 2. Before we go, we're heading back to the sewers one last time for two very special interviews. Our first is with composer Benjamin Wallfisch, who walks us through his two epic scores, offering some incredible insight into the music that's made us cry as much as it's made us recoil in terror. After that, we'll reunite with director Andy Muschietti, who shares a wealth of trivia not only about the two chapters, but what's in store for a proposed supercut he's currently working on. We think it's a pretty fitting conclusion to our vacation in Derry, so grab your rain boots, maybe even a raincoat, and head into the Greywater with the Losers Club.
Hello, is this Mr. Wallfisch?
Yes, speaking.
Hi, this is Michael Rothman from Consequence of Sound and the Losers Club podcast.
Hi, Michael.
How are you doing? Good. How are you doing?
Excellent. Yeah, very well. Thank you.
Well, the film is now in theaters. The two-part epic is complete. How do you feel about it? Are you are you happy that this journey is complete? Do you feel a little sad, nostalgic? What are your feelings right now?
There's definitely a sense of yes, it's always sad when something this huge comes to an end, in terms of, you know, it's been a 2.5 year journey for me, and one I just feel so fortunate and, you know, honored to have been a part of, and the collaboration you build with a filmmaker like Andy Muschietti and Barbara Muschietti, they've become such dear friends, and, you know, the Losers Club as a group, you know, the film is so rooted in friendship, mm-hmm. and that sense of what happens when, you know, people come together with a single purpose, and yeah, so I think I'm just incredibly excited that the movie is finally out in the world, and yeah, and also whenever I finish a film I love, there's always a sense of you know, that feeling when you finish a fantastic book and you just don't want to, you know, turn that last page.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, and honestly, it's just such an affecting score. And I always can tell that there's a personal favorite of mine when I can use the score for writing or for, you know, to be around the house. Granted, there are definitely moments of this score where I definitely jump and, you know, turn my head a little bit if I'm like cleaning around the house and have it playing. Yeah. But, you know, yeah. It's so emotional and it's so gripping in all the right ways. And, you know, and I wondered, you know, going into this, did you see it, you know, both chapters as a horror film, a blockbuster, a drama? Like, you know, does genre even inform your approach at all when you're composing?
I saw it very much as an adventure film, mm-hmm. and one that's anchored in a story about young people coming of age, through a process where they're forced to confront their deepest fears. And they do so in the context of already feeling like outcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And so they create their own family in the form of what becomes the Losers Club. Just in the context that, you know, they are anyway trying to find meaning in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to literally, they realize the difference between being together is life and death. And the fact that they have to defeat something unimaginably horrifying because it knows how to get under the individual skin of each of them. There's something so potent where you have to anchor the musical storytelling in what is effectively the nature of friendship and mm-hmm. the nature of a found family and the very distinct kind of love that is. And then go from that to these really visceral, visceral amount of drama and horror. And I guess the way to draw those two things together was to think of it in terms of it's an adventure.
Yeah.
It's an adventure story, but it's a story which has incredible subtext and depth. And the music just needed to kind of, I just always was just trying to live up to the movie and its incredible scale and ambition. Andy's style of filmmaking is he never holds back from emotion. He will always want to, he puts that first in mm-hmm. the performance in every choice. And whenever that's one of the reasons I love working with him is that he always wants to go for that potency in music, which mm-hmm. is to create that emotional subtext, and always pushed me to go as far as I could with that. So it's a very unique film, and the two films are taken as a whole really do feel like a journey and a cathartic experience.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned scale, and I wondered. I don't think anyone really could have ever predicted how big, you know, of an event the first one became in 2017. I mean, it just was a worldwide phenomenon. It became the highest grossing horror film of all time. You know, going into chapter two, did that outside context, you know, affect the approach to this score? Like, I'm wonder probably it affected the production itself, just making it bigger and better, you know, like bolder and whatnot with the scope. But, you know, did that translate to the music too?
Well, I was lucky enough to have a much bigger scope in terms of we could use a much larger orchestra, and we were, you know, there's also the movie just demanded that. It
yeah.
wasn't so much of a practical thing of let's just throw more money at this. It was like this story requires so much, a much grander canvas,
mm-hmm.
and every department had to rise to that. What was so exciting was returning to these themes and the sort of philosophy of the first score, and then just amping it up with 27 years almost maturing is the wrong
yeah.
word, but that sense that something has had time to gestate and evolve, and then you return to it. That was the kind of feeling I was trying to create. And of course, it's the most exciting thing in the world when you're, you know, part of a movie which is a huge hit, and I felt so lucky to have been part of that. But when you return to it, you have to put all that to one side and think only about the storytelling and the fact that, you know, here's an opportunity, and you know, what is our last opportunity in many ways to kind of bring this home for the audience in such a way that they really feel that sense of conclusion mm-hmm. and catharsis. And a big part of that was that philosophy of really going big and not holding back in any of the choices. And that doesn't necessarily mean use a huge orchestra and write a lot of music. It was more about like the choices needed to be that much more ambitious
mm-hmm.
at every turn.
Well, you know, you'd mentioned, I like the idea of the maturing because that's such a, you know, key aspect of this story. And, you know, with the piano being kind of the backbone of the score and it fuels so much of the innocence with the kids in the original one. You know, going into this second chapter, what were your own personal challenges in trying to find that sort of adulthood for the adults and, you know, evolving past themes and making them somewhat new, but also echoes of the past? Like, you kind of had to, you know, juggle a little bit there. Was that a struggle for you?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's always a struggle when yeah. you start any new film. And, and it's the best kind of struggle because you have to force yourself to start with a blank canvas, so that every choice you make is utterly bespoke and of the fabric of this movie and the filmmaker's own choices and how he sees the music fitting in with that, and then how you're going to interpret that and make it, you know, bring your own aspect and own voice to it. But with this particular film, I think one of the biggest challenges was to almost, you know, run with those themes which have, you know, become a big part of the first film, and reinvent them in such a way that they didn't feel like we're just, you know, just for the sake of it changing. That everything had to have a reason and a context. And I found that the big trick was actually finding a new way of harmonizing these themes, and also giving their context more meaning. So that Pennywise's main theme in the first movie is pretty much exclusively attached to him. In the second movie, that theme actually takes on a much bigger role. It becomes like the main theme of the movie. If you think like that, it's almost like the dairy theme. You can't really give it a character name. It just becomes the it theme.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And you hear it much more frequently. And every time you hear it, it goes one step further in terms of the orchestration, harmonic choices. And it was very interesting sort of seeing if that tune, which was designed to be quite an innocuous, strange chromatic theme, which never really found a conclusion, could it scale up to being, you know, the main theme? And unfortunately it could. And with that brings all kinds of other challenges to kind of execute that. And I mean, it was very important also to come up with new themes as well.
Oh, totally.
So that there were, you know, that sense of development, and the fact that, you know, the conceptually too, the idea of memory and trauma, there's a sort of quite an existential thread through the film now, but again, like any project, even if it's part, because again, this isn't a sequel, it's part two of a much longer story. I think the most important part was, I remember when I was writing the first movie, knowing there would be a part two, was to leave enough to then return to and develop in the second part.
That's very wise. you know,
I mean, but of course it's so hard to do because you want to throw everything at the film itself. But
yeah.
I personally, I'm just glad that 2 years passed, because of course, you know, you change as well yourself in that time. And I think that was a big part of it as well.
Oh, I can't even imagine. I mean, just in that time alone, I mean, especially your amazing Hail Mary score for Blade Runner 2049, which was just fantastic and one of our favorites of that year. And I know that was kind of a fast 180. And, you know, given the you know, proximity of time, I did wonder, did you have a little bit more flexibility leading up to chapter two versus chapter one? You know, was there more of a time crunch? Like, how was it kind of the same?
It was similar. I had about 5 months
to
work on it, which was, I think the difference was we had a lot more recording time, just because there was a lot more music to record. So yeah, the process was a little bit longer but I had the advantage of, you know, 18 months of kind of whenever I wasn't writing or something else, you know, just thinking about it and, you know, reading the book and just really kind of just starting to kind of conceptualize, so that by the time I actually got down to writing, there was some things in place.
Oh, that's interesting. So you were actually reading the book then from Stephen King? That's really interesting.
Right.
Oh, awesome. Had you read Stephen King prior to that, or are you a fan of his work?
Oh, huge fan.
Yeah,
absolutely. I've been, since I was a kid, I've always loved his books. So it was kind of interesting to get the core when I did that a couple of years ago.
Had you read the book prior to doing this production?
No. When I got the job, I was like, okay, I really should read the book, but of course it's so huge.
Yeah.
I didn't quite finish it. I got as far as I think the first sort of 30%, and then I just realized I could either read this book or write the score. So I should. So it was nice to have that intervening time where I could sit down and read it properly.
When you were reading it for ahead of chapter two, were you listening to your score while reading it?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I never listen to my scores. When I finish them, I always move on to the next. I never listen.
Interesting.
I hate making show reels. Yeah, because it's interesting because, yeah, it's you put everything into it and then it's done. And you sort of want to save yourself for the next one in a way, and have that philosophy of you know, treating each new project as a completely new you need to bring a new aspect of yourself every time, even if it's a sequel, you know, there's a new story to be told always.
Yeah, it's a little like what Don Henley says in Boys of Summer. It's like, you can't look back, you never look back.
That's right.
Yeah. So with talking about respective themes, you know, there's seven members. There's Pennywise, there's Derry, there's just, you know, there's Bowers. Did you, you know, try to kind of carve out like respective themes for each, you know, person? Did you have each loser in mind? I mean, especially with the walking tours in this one, you know, where they all kind of go off on their own.
The Losers Club for me has always had its own feeling, and as such, there is a Losers Club theme, which is, you know, the piano piece every 27 years, which when you don't see the concept, you obviously hear that tune for the first time with, you know, Bill's and George's mother playing it with the rain outside. It's just a piece of music, but it's deliberately very contemplative and quite emotional and surprising harmonically.
Yeah.
In the same way as the complexity of that of the relationships of the Losers Club are. And there's a moment in the second movie, I don't want to say too much, so not to spoil anything, but it's one of the moments where we flash back to a moment with the Losers Club that we didn't see in the first movie. But it's such an integral part of the story. And that was the very first time I made the explicit connection between that theme, which I just called Every 27 Years, and the Losers Club. Mm-hmm. And it was a special moment for me to be able to finally like say, yes, that is the Losers Club theme. And so as such, there wasn't really a need to then, you know, give individual tunes to each. With the exception of Beverly, she has such an impact on the group. Mm-hmm. Obviously, particularly the relationship with Bill and then Ben, and the way that, you know, the complexity of the poem, you know, Harris Went to Fire, and you know that beautiful subplot of how when she eventually realizes who wrote that. Again, with that unfolds. So there is the Beverly theme. Which starts life in a very simple form, and it's just the kind of from the point of view of Bill and the other boys in the club, of course. But eventually, that tune evolves into what becomes they're two separate themes actually, but the Blood Oath theme and also the sense of memory and nostalgia. Mm-hmm. It's inspired by Beverly's presence and sort of emanates outwards into that. You know, there's a very beautiful moment, which I'm not going to say anything about, towards the end of the film, where it, the only thing that I could possibly do was to reprise that in that context, that the Losers Club is anchored in love and anchored in this unbreakable friendship that lasts their whole lives, and that is ultimately at the core of this film is how powerful that is, you know, true friendship. What is that, and how the healing power of that, and just how profound that is. That's what really drove the score.
Oh, and honestly, I think you connect with it, you know, just right on target. I mean, that for me, the most affecting part of this movie is just that entire narrative, for sure, and just those emotions and those feelings. And, you know, I found myself just welling up so many times throughout the first chapter, and especially towards the end of this chapter. And I think a lot of it does have to do with those echoes and those in the returns to those signature melodies. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, a few months ago, we actually were speaking to composer Christopher Young. And, you know, I asked him, you know, why is it that we don't really have too many signature like themes in, you know, especially in horror these days? You know, like back in the 80s, you'd be able to recall the Friday the 13th or A Nightmare on Elm Street or Halloween. And, you know, and a lot of it, he was saying, well, it's kind of unorthodox these days because there's like, you know, most composers and studios want soundscapes. And I actually felt like, you know, both chapters here and your work really do kind of harken back to those days in a way, but also kind of melding with the, you know, the world of today, of just kind of going with those soundscapes and atmospheres. And I wondered, like, did you have that in mind? Was that a conceit of yours to be able to kind of create, you know, signature themes in the style and vein of those movies?
I've always loved the films, you know, I grew up in the 80s with the peak of the Spielberg-Williams collaboration, and was utterly obsessed with Star Wars and E.T. and Back to the Future and these films, which where the score is so much a character in the narrative. And I mean, it's amazing watching a movie like Back to the Future and imagining the music isn't there and just how much smaller it would feel.
I know,
in many ways. And it's, I always find that magical, and Andy Muschietti's filmmaking style is so powerful and visceral and virtuosic. And like I was saying earlier, you know, his emphasis on emotion and emotional narrative is always at the forefront. And he's also a fantastic musician. He understands music in such a deep way, and has such incredibly such great taste musically too. Coming back to work with Andy was just, it was just such a joy, because we already had such an enjoyable time basically sharing the same, you know. He's also a huge fan of the music of the 80s, both not just film music but just generally the music of that time. And we just have that shared love, and ultimately the movie just demands it. There's just so much depth to the story, and without theme it's so hard to live up to that musically. It's a movie which was, you know, the film rejects a lot of, you know, if you were to do a very contemporary modern score, which works for so many other kinds of films, it's not necessarily a bad thing. If it works for the film, it's the right thing to do. But this movie just, you know, it was a sort of film where, unless you were always being as narrative as possible, and it just didn't work, musically narrative. And also the long form approach where you set up thematic tension at various points that needs to be resolved in that arc form. That was also a very powerful part of how the film works structurally. So I was able to really, you know, run with that. So that when there's moments of horror, it's always in the context of a story point where you are so invested in the outcome of that moment, because you're so connected with those characters. So it's strange in a way, you know. Obviously it's out there as a horror film, but it's, in my head, it's, there's so much more to it than that.
Oh, absolutely.
And certainly from my musical point of view, using theme from to connect the character and to propel the story was really the only way we could do it.
What are your favorite themes in these two scores?
It's such a difficult question, because there's, in my head, there's always more to do. You know, I'm never fully happy with any score I finish.
creative.
So asking me what's my favorite theme is a tricky question, because the theme which I probably took me the longest to really get right was the Losers Club theme, the Every 27 Years piece, the piano piece.
I love that.
Because it had to feel, there had to be this sort of inherent simplicity and honesty, because they're kids. And so this, you know, you will always get the truth. but there was, in terms of emotion, but then of course it needed to live up to the complexity of their evolving relationships and where eventually that would go, in terms of how they come to realize that unless they function as a group, they're not going to survive at all. Mm-hmm. So I think as a theme that was probably the one which, and deliberately it's used very sparingly in the film. It's used only as a bookmark, effectively at the beginning and the end of the first movie, and then in the middle and at the end of the second film. But that if you use it more than that, it becomes too much. So yeah, that was certainly the one of the hardest themes to come up with. If that's any measure to your question.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Kind of on that topic, and I know this definitely was a challenging theme. I wondered what were some challenging scenes in this one, especially because, you know, with chapter two, I feel like there's just such a big mix of, you know, drama and horror, but also comedy. You know, I was surprised by, you know, some more comedic elements in this movie. And I wondered, did that prove difficult also to kind of dance around a little bit too?
Right. I mean, every scene had its own unique set of challenges, and also connecting everything. So it feels, you know, very much part of this mission that they create for themselves as adults when they come back. Interestingly, probably one of the hardest sequences was one of the simplest, which is a montage where, again, not wanting to give too much away, but we see a flashback of Stan at his bar mitzvah, and that sets off a series of images and memories of key moments within the Losers Club. It's a very short sequence; it's about 90 seconds long. But I was still rewriting that cue as we were recording. There were so many iterations, and Andy and I were just both trying to figure out how to really bring home the truth of what that scene is, which is it's a turning point in the story. And it also reminds the audience of the power of connection that these kids have, and how just that is enough to defeat this unimaginable shape-shifting entity from another dimension. The potent humanness of that. And I think that's why it was such a struggle, because when you're trying to capture that in music, you know, you can so easily do too much and be too complex. And it was actually about stripping everything away down to something so simple. And that's often the hardest thing to do. It's so fun to go all in with a 100-piece orchestra and choir and go completely as big as you can go, and that's just really fun. It still has its own challenges, but yeah, going the other direction, we nailed it towards the end of the recording period, and finally we got that one down.
Well, thank God. One of the things that I also noticed in this one is that it seems like it gets a little more experimental. You know, there's especially on the track, you know, Your Winner, you know, Your Hair Is Winter Fire. There seems to be this very garish, not garish, but very abrasive crunching effect that also made me recall of Hans Zimmer's work in like The Dark Knight, when him and I believe James Newton Howard were kind of doing some crazy wire work there. I, you know, wanted to ask, like, because this literally sounds like you're bending a pipe, and I wondered if you had any unorthodox instrumentation for this go around.
It was one of the things Andy and I were trying to experiment with, was in contrast with the scale of the orchestra in the final part of the film, we wanted to see what happens when we go incredibly small with literally one or two musicians and record them with about, you know, seven microphones, but as close as you can get without interfering with their playing. and just really get them to kind of almost destroy the instrument within reason, using, you know, all kinds of extended techniques developed by composers like Penderecki, Lutoslawski, and John Cage. You know, the height of experimental concert music in the 60s and 70s, also in Darmstadt in Germany, where composers really went off the rails in the best possible way, sonically. And, you know, having gone through that incredible experience on Blade Runner, collaborating with my dear friend Hans and these incredible filmmakers, where we had the opposite thing where we were not using the orchestra at all. We were only using synthesizers and electronics. You know, there you have, you know, literally everything is possible. It was that the challenge of what happens if we are using only acoustic instruments, which we can then manipulate digitally. But the you hear the human struggle in the performance, which you can't necessarily get. And it seemed very apt in certain sequences to especially where, you know, the fact that Pennywise is that much more vengeful, and Henry Bowers' character is much more important in this film too, as almost like Pennywise's sort of lieutenant almost. There was that need to come up with a new sound that wasn't just everything we've heard before.
Yeah.
And we created that using we hired for 9 hours. We worked with the full orchestra about 3 months before we did the final scoring, where I recorded probably about 2 hours of material away from picture, all experimental sonic textures, you know, both using themes and not. And a big part of that was then, you know, letting the whole orchestra go at the end and leaving just basically a string quartet. And that material got used a lot in the final thing. Yeah.
God, it was used to brilliant effect though. I just loved it. It's very spooky. Like just listening to it with headphones, it just sent like shivers up my spine a couple of times. But you mentioned Hans Zimmer, and I always wondered, like, how did you two hook up, and do you have any more collaborations in the future together?
Well, Hans has become truly a mental figure for me and a very, very close friend. He reached out to me, and he tells the story much better. He heard one of my very early scores, I think on Apple TV back when, even before, I mean, this is going back maybe 7 years now. And he reached out to me, through an email he found, but, he didn't get a response because it actually wasn't my email address. And, so from his point of view, he'd written this lovely, very generous email to this young unknown composer who just didn't bother replying. And then eventually through a mutual friend, Richard Harvey, because I was planning on moving to LA, and one of the first things you do is see if you can talk to Hans just to get some advice. And I asked Richard to connect us, and he called Hans and said, "Oh, is that guy? Yeah, he never." But the funny thing is that when we did eventually connect through Richard, about a week later, Hans received an email from someone called Ben Valfish, who said, "I think you mean the composer. I'm the lawyer, Ben Valfish." He'd written to a lawyer in Texas. So it was just one of those funny things, which he tells the story much better than I do.
Yeah.
And we just very quickly formed a friendship. We didn't work together for 2 or 3 years after that initial meeting we had. And then we worked together on 12 Years a Slave. He invited me to contribute to that score, which really was the beginning of you know, what's become an incredibly important relationship to me, just in terms of, you know, there's no one like Hans in terms of mentorship and in terms of extraordinary insight into the art and the craft of storytelling through music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has such an innate sense of not just story for its own sake, but how you can be a pioneer and think, you know, think almost like a revolutionary. I mean, I think that's always been his thing, is to constantly disrupt and change what feels established. And I feel very lucky to have spent so much time with him. And he's also, you know, he always describes this of, you know, when he opened up a relationship between myself and Gore Verbinski, for 12 Years a Slave, for A Cure for Wellness. Mm-hmm. And that process, I think was the key turning point for me in my own personal journey from being just a musician to really starting to think purely as a, to think as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And to think in terms of story. And, so those sort of relationships which he's enabled have been so instrumental. And yes, I would be so happy to collaborate with Hans again. It's always just such an exciting and it's like being in a band. You get together almost like two songwriters and you're constantly challenging each other. Mm-hmm. Coming up with ideas and critiquing each other's, and that kind of back and forth is always very inspiring with Hans. And so yes, let's see what happens. We've both been very busy with our own, solo project. I mean, him obviously, yeah. The biggest movies in the world, if the chance comes up, I would be honored to continue working with him. We're in touch all the time.
Well, have you and Andy Muschietti discussed collaborating further?
Yes, I mean, Andy and I have become real.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a great partnership there, which I just was so lucky to have, because he's the kind of filmmaker, there are so few, sort of two or three in a generation, really. He's such a visionary and a virtuoso, and I feel very lucky to have established the relationship I do with him. So absolutely, it would be a huge joy.
Got it. I always love that when that happens, when you could get, the filmmaker and composer that can, continues down the road. Mr. Wallfish, thank you so much for speaking to me this afternoon.
Thank you. Well, of course. Yeah, we'll be in touch. All right.
Absolutely.
Thanks again.
Have a good one.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Still with us? Good. We're not through yet. The waters are rough, but I think I see some light up ahead. Something tells me that's where we'll find Andy. Stay strong. Stay together.
Hi, Michael.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm very good. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Now that both chapters are out, they're both huge successes. This is quite a journey. How are you feeling? Are you feeling, assured? Do you feel nostalgic a little bit? What's going on through your head?
Yeah,
right now?
Both.
Yeah.
There's a lot of mixed emotions. It's a whirlpool of emotions. I'm very, satisfied, and I have this sense of closure.
Mm-hmm.
That it's very important after all, all those years. But again, it's sad because it's been a journey with a lot of people, human element there that was very important. And it will never happen the same way it did,
Mm-hmm.
Chapter one, chapter two was completely different, but chapter two was really, really exhilarating because it was going back to that great summer. So we went back to Port Hope, Derry, mm-hmm. Get together with the family, both cast and crew. It really couldn't have gone better. The outcome of it was just the second movie that was, people who really loved the first movie really got what the second movie was.
Yeah.
About. Yeah. And it was everything they expected and more.
There's been a lot of chatter now that both chapters are out and all there for consumption,
yeah.
That, some people are taking it as a coming of age movie. Some people are, approaching it and still digesting it as a horror film. How do you describe these two movies as a whole?
Well, it's both things, it's a two voiced movie. It's mm-hmm. a two voiced story. It's two different perspectives
mm-hmm.
on life. And I told this before, it's what it is a love letter to childhood.
Yeah.
And it talks about the end of childhood and, antagonizes childhood to adulthood. And we see this story told from two perspectives, mm-hmm. one through the eyes of the characters as kids, and the second one through the eyes of these characters as adults. there is a unity mm-hmm. in this, like two sides. It's like a balance that you know, finally reaches, you know, a one voice. And I like to see it, you know, as that, as one story told from two perspectives.
Yeah. 2 years ago when we spoke, I don't think any of us could have ever predicted just how big of a phenomenon the first one would become. And, you know, going into chapter two, did the blockbuster success of chapter one change your approach at all? You know, when you...
No, well, it's just, you know, they ask me about, like, sometimes they ask me about the pressure. Did the pressure, like, you know, rise suddenly because it was like there was more expectations and stuff. But it really didn't. Oh, the effect of chapter one being a success for me was very stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
So it threw me into, you know, just like making something better. Not that I wasn't planning to do something good.
Of course not.
But no. if anything, it just, you know, excited me more. There was never you know, like a moment of like of freezing or saying, oh, what I'm going to do now. No, it's like quite the opposite. It was like really stimulating because, you know, the love of the people can only, you know, reassure you. Being that it's a story that is like a second part of a story of the second part of something that they know already with characters that they love. It just throws you into, okay, let's do this with, and it just propulses you into, you know, basically giving them the conclusion.
Yeah.
Of course, I had, you know, on the other hand, I had, you know, a lot of bigger budget, mm-hmm. more resources, and I knew that I could actually shoot my movie with more days, more time, more money, and that was like reassuring too, because I had to basically cut a lot of corners on the first one.
Yeah.
With the budget limitations. Not that it was a low budget for a horror movie. It was pretty high. But mm-hmm. you see the movie. It's a big... chapter one is smaller than chapter two, but it's still a big movie with a scope and, you know, a lot of characters. And so, yeah. But the truth is that I had budget limitations. I had to, you know, to compromise some things in the first one, and knowing that that wouldn't happen in the second one was even more, you know, stimulating.
Totally. I mean, chapter two even takes seemingly more of a surrealistic approach at times, you know, like with the puzzle pieces, the dual shots of Ben and Bev. Mm-hmm. Did you mm-hmm. feel like you had a little bit more free rein because of that? Like, did you just have like a bigger sandbox, is, you know, especially
bigger,
like,
sandbox? Yeah, definitely. You know, when I think, I don't, normally I don't think of money when I'm like thinking of story or sequences or, you know, set pieces. That comes later as a, you know, when I come and I say like, okay, this is the scene, this is the sequence. And then, you know, I talk to my sister, who's a producer and airline producer, and he's like, okay, this is what your scene costs. So I never, cut myself before creating a sequence. It's just a bit of reality at the end when sometimes when it's like, okay, but it never like made me cut off stuff. Mm-hmm. You always have to, you know, when you get back the cost of the scene, but everyone's on board. So they might ask you, okay, so you have to make a balance here because we're a little over, we need to, you know, maybe cut somewhere else, mm-hmm. you know? So that juggling is part of a director's work, you know, and it's always been, you have to pick your battles,
yeah,
in a way, because not everything, you know, you can't have everything.
Basically.
Of course, the bigger the budget, the a little more you can have.
Yeah.
But you're always like playing on the edge, you know. Mm-hmm. Always playing the edge. And I met, you know, like sort of like, you know, budgetary challenges on this one too, because the bigger, you know, The more resources you get, also the bigger. I mean, this is from the story as it should be told, right?
Yeah.
So the studio gives you more money, but then you go a little further, and that's when you meet, like, you know, the walls of the budget, and then you have to negotiate whether it's you yourself basically balancing the budget and basically pondering the importance of each scene.
Mm-hmm.
And how much, you know, resources you have to give to either, or going back to the studio and asking for more money.
Yeah. Well, it seems like you got a lot in.
And that dance,
you know.
Yeah, I can't complain. I'm telling you, of all the movies that I made, this is the one where I got more.
You've talked about how you have, you know, a director's cut for the first one and for the second one, and, you know, you teased a comprehensive cut, you know, putting them together. How would you see that cut? Would you try to rearrange it similar to the book?
We call it the super cut. it's very early stage, you know. Like, we're like sort of discussing, the studio is not like completely, you know, it's not a decision yet. But I, you know, it won't be like intertwined or anything like the way it's in the book, but it will contain, all the scenes that were deleted from both movies.
Yeah.
For, you know, for pacing reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we'll have like new material, which is stuff that I haven't shot yet.
Oh, wow. So are you going to go back to do reshoots?
Yes. Oh. But it's again, it's not even a discussion. We just like toyed with the idea, mm-hmm. with the studio, but you know, you have to, like, we're not there yet. Wow. But it would be great.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, imagine like having in front of you, like the two movies, view them, you know, see them in as a whole.
Yeah.
Which is something that I never did yet, and you know, recalibrating things and say, okay, you know what, it would be great, like seeing whatever, Richie flying on the Macroverse or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Speaking of recalibration, you have so much of chapter one that's influencing and informing chapter two. Were there moments where you realized that you wish you could have tinkered with the first one?
No, you know what? No, not really. I was frustrated on the first one because I couldn't do things that I ended up doing on the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And we found the logic. We found the perfect logic for not having it in the first one. Like the whole clubhouse thing, I couldn't find a way to put it on chapter one. You know, when there's a lot of things that you like from the book, but then when you translate the story into a film language, you really have to squeeze the story into like a series of events,
mm-hmm.
that are propulsing and they're consequential, and they make like for a great film experience. And unfortunately, you have to have some of those events out because they just don't fit the new narrative.
Yeah.
And the clubhouse was one of them. The clubhouse, this is like the place that saw this group like really flourish as a group of friends. And so I was in love with the clubhouse, and then I managed to put it back on the second one.
You know, there had been a lot of discussions about the, you know, this quote unquote origin story with Pennywise. And, you know, was that ever shot? Was that ever, you know, intended to be included in either chapter? Is it something that you would want to revisit for a sequel of sorts? Like a Pennywise origin.
There is a scene that we shot that is a scene in the, you know, 1600s. I decided not to put it in the film because it was a little confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know what the problem is? Like, there's like, people want sometimes to know a little more, but mm-hmm. if you give them too much, then they are, you know, they're like disappointed.
Yeah.
It's like a magic trick in a way.
Yeah.
And I think if you go back to the book, something similar happens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen King remains very cryptic about, you know, the other side, the origin of Pennywise. And he teases you with Robert Gray and this and that. And the turtle, and then at the end he sort of like, you know, unveils, like opens the curtain and shows you a lot about the, you know, the other side, the Macroverse. But I learned from that sometimes it's better not to, you know, to keep things a little cryptic to generate that mystery. And it's a balance that you have to find for yourself, you know,
I agree.
As you're putting the movie together. And the editing has a lot, is so much to do with that, you know? You have a comprehension with the story, with the script, and the effect that it has on the audience. But then when you, when your movie is edited, that, you know, that notion is more clear.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And well, of course, there's this thing called the test screening, which is give you like a more vivid image.
Yeah.
And vivid notion of what people are feeling at every point. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, so that scene, regarding that scene, is a scene that I love. I would have to see how we orchestrated in the big cut if it happens.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever consider making another chapter, or like a prequel of sorts?
It's hard. It's too soon to tell. Of course, like, you know, it's the universe and the, you know, the cosmology of this story is so rich.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen King, you know, makes this huge, like, mythology just as a canvas for the story of the losers and Pennywise. But it's so rich, you know, and it really has, like, you know, outstanding events in the past that are so awesome. Like,
yeah.
You know, the story of Bob Gray. It's a huge mystery there.
Yeah.
Bob Gray, who was the clown, who, you know, paid his faith and became Pennywise. Why did it took this as the basic incarnation? How did it happen? You know, there's a lot of questions. It's very intriguing to me.
Yeah. Well, speaking of universes, you know, like cinematic universes are all the rage, and with it being part of Warner Brothers, which owns like so many King properties, and they're going to be issuing out Dr. Sleep soon. Was there ever any talk of trying to kind of set any sort of foundation for that to maybe springboard to other King properties within this one? I know there's a lot of Easter eggs to a lot of his works within both movies, but was that something that was ever discussed behind the scenes?
For like, for me to direct other Stephen King movies,
or even just like planting the seeds for something and within these movies. You know?
It was never like a plan. Mm-hmm. You know, of course it's great to think about it, and you know, of course I'm excited about the, you know, exploring other possible stories in within the mythology of it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it was never a plan. The plan was always like making it as two movies and stop.
Probably smart.
It was. That's what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you had enough on your plate at that
but
point.
I never, to be honest, I never had a discussion with the studio about, you know, making like the commercial implications of it, the commercial like possibilities, opportunities. I never had one.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the more touching moments, especially, you know, just as a longtime King, you know, reader and just fan, is seeing him in the movie. And this is probably his most prominent cameo. You know, how long was King on set? You know, as a longtime fan yourself, was it kind of intimidating to shoot him on the scene?
He came for 3 days. So he, you know, I offered him the cameo. It was funny because, you know, he asked, I wrote an email to him, you know, offering the cameo, and he said, well, you have to have in mind that I'm a jinx. every movie that I've been in, bombed. So he said that as a joke, you know. I don't know how much of that is true, but I thought it was very funny.
Yeah.
So I wrote him back and I said, I think we can break the spell.
Yeah.
And he was in. He was immediately in, and the scene was a little scene, and then when Stephen signed in, I thought of making it bigger.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, I can't help myself. And I thought, yeah, if you're gonna have it, let's make him play.
Yeah.
Because he's great. He can do it. So so the scene grew up a little bit in the pages, a couple more lines exchange and stuff, but the time that he really came alive, it was on set.
Aww.
And you know, we improvised this idea where, you know, McAvoy says, you know, starts stuttering. So James came up with the idea of stuttering. and generating like this frustrating moment. And I said, okay, so if we're going to do that, let's make it really frustrating. And so that's why I asked Steve to say things that, you know, all the things that start with B, all those words that with B, because like, you know, Magawa comes in and says, bowling ball, baseball, cards. So it was great. It was great because then everyone got excited about the possibilities of the scene, and I could see like Steven writing on his little notebook like all the words that like started with B, of objects that you can find on the thrift shop, and he wrote like 15, and we shot them all.
Oh wow!
So he came up with words like Bobby and Ken, bulldozer, bird cage, and so in the longer version of the scene, he says them all, but it's like it's a little bit of an overkill. Yeah,
that's awesome. Too long.
Thanks.
No, we
had a lot of fun. And directing him was like a piece of cake. Like when it was very relaxed.
Yeah.
And at one point, I just we were having a lot of fun. So I just forgot that, you know, I was talking to Stephen King, you know, like that hero on a pedestal. It's just like, you know, a very funny guy.
Did you get any one-on-one moments with him on set where you can kind of just like pull him aside and just talk for a little bit or?
Oh yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, of course. But he all through, he stayed like 3 days in Port Hope. I mean, he could have just like flew in and out,
yeah,
but he was having such a, you know, I think he had a very good time. He came in with his grandson, Ethan.
Aww.
Joe Hill's son.
Yeah.
Who is in college now, and he's a big fan of Chapter One. So we had a real, real good time there.
Oh, and I bet he must have loved being with like all the kids and stuff there. I mean, it's got to be, it's a playground for the most part.
I think for him, absolutely. I think for him it was, you know, like he really likes Chapter One.
Yeah.
And I think he got like excited about like being around the, you know, in production too. And, you know, there's been so many adaptations of his work. So, you know, there's good and not so good. And I think that the fact that the Chapter One was so well received and that, you know, he personally liked it so much, it must have been very gratifying for him.
Oh, totally.
The day he came on set, we were in the middle of a scene, which is a scene where Eddie gets stabbed in the face by Henry Bowers. And I remember PJ, like, you know, being on standby there inside the set. I was out of the set on my monitor, and Stephen King arrives, and we greet him, blah, blah. And I said, and I asked Stephen to shout action so he could actually, he directed that scene.
Oh, and awesome.
PJ never realized that it was, yeah. So it was like action. Oh, Stephen.
Love it. I
action.
Love it.
And then, yeah.
Well, you know, there's some really interesting changes with just the narrative itself. And I know when we talked back in 2017, we're really trying to pry to know if Maturin and the turtle were all going to be involved. And I just thought that the way that you incorporated a lot of the spiritual elements was just, I mean, I was literally sitting in the screen and just being like, I can't believe they're fucking doing this. This is amazing. Was there a lot of discussion on how far you were going to lean into that? Was there ever a draft or even more ideas to go even further into it? Like even like a literal appearance of Maturin?
Yeah, well, I did, you know, there was something essential and conceptual that I always knew, that it was like, I want to keep the perspective in which this story is told, human. I want to keep it, you know, in the human drama from the human perspective, from this character's perspective. Jumping to the other side and seeing like all, you know, the place where actually it comes from. For me, I didn't want to run the risk of making this a fantasy movie.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, for me, that was always a question, you know, how much of the other thing should reveal. And I didn't want to go sort of, you know, quote, Dark Tower, where they're always, you know, the fantasy element is very present. So, yeah, and that the only reason for that is just like keeping, you know, keeping a story about a human experience. Yeah. Even though, like, the monster or the villain definitely is a, you know, interdimensional evil. But yes, you know, the mentions to the turtle as, you know, as a force of good. So I kept them, you know, very subtle, and the presence of the turtle is always, you know, very, very, very subtle. I do have a scene that you won't see, that it's not in the movie, that I had to lift, that has a little more turtle. It's an actual turtle. And so when you see McAvoy confronting his fear in the flooded basement, and he, you know, he kills Georgie, and he kills the notion of guilt by killing himself as a kid.
So dark, I love it.
He just, you know, just jumps back in the water, and now he's like, you know, he's lost. There is no way out, and suddenly, like the eyes of Pennywise, or Pennywise Bill, that was the kid, come out of the dark, and it's not Pennywise, it's a turtle that is swimming just by him, and he's just the turtle, and he's like sort of fascinated, what is this thing, and very soon after we see the kids swimming behind it.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so McAvoy just follows them towards the light, and he emerges back in the cavern.
So
yeah, I think it's a beautiful scene, but I had to leave it out because of, you know, pacing reasons. It was very emotional, but it was probably not in the right moment where things had to move faster. Oh yeah, it's connected. It's a scene that is connected to chapter one.
Yeah.
When you see the kids in the quarry and they're like, you know, splashing around, one of them says, "Oh, something in the water. What is it? A turtle." And they all go into the water. So this is a bit of what happens, you know, it's a continuation of that scene where the kids are actually swimming behind the turtle.
Oh, I love it.
Very beautiful, very emotional. But it's like, you know, in the moment where the movie is really pacing up, and it's like the rhythm is like quick, was a bit of a wedge.
Are you going to try to fit it into the supercut?
What do you think?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I know you're such a huge Constant reader, and when we talked last, you seemed interested in doing The Jaunt, and now you're attached to Roadwork. You know, what is drawing you to Roadwork, actually? You know, because that was such a left of the dial choice, and I was literally shocked by that when I saw it. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. You know, what is it about the story that's speaking to you? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's not the, you know, Roadwork is a more human, you know, definitely more human drama that I always loved it. You know, it's not one of its like biggest hits.
Yeah.
But it always resonated. I can't really explain why, you know, like stories like The Jaunt also like stayed with me for years. And then, you know, I know Pablo Trapero since we were in film school. His career like went great. He's done like so many good movies. And, you know, speaking about things, just like the idea of Roadwork came up, and he showed a lot of interest in, so that's how it happened. Again, I don't know.
Are you gonna still do The Jaunt? Do you think you're still gonna chase after that one?
We are. Well, that has been developing with, you know, with Plan B for a few years. We've been trying to crack it, and now like, finally we have a writer that can that can do it. And so I would love to, you know, it's tough to crack because it's such a great like short story.
Yeah.
But then you have to, you know, expand it into a great, you know, film narrative. So it took a while, but now I think we got it. I don't want to tell too much about it.
I won't pry too much. Well, yeah. Mr. Muschietti, thank you so much. I will say,
of course,
speaking on all the horror hounds out there, we absolutely want you to bring back A Nightmare on Elm Street. We think that you're perfect for it. Just make it happen. After watching this movie, I was like, I think all of us, Brad Misko over at Brilliant Disgusting brought it up first, and he was just like, how great would it be if he tackled that franchise? So please knock on that door for all of us.
Okay. Okay, I have it in mind.
All right, great.
I have it in mind. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. And good luck with everything. I can't wait for the supercut. And just thank you for this awesome adventure.
Oh, thank you, Michael. I'm very glad that you dig it.
Thanks. Have a great one.
Thank you, Michael. Bye.
Bye.
And that's that. Thank you so much for joining us on this adventure through Derry over these past couple of months. We're a little sad to leave, especially since we love the Chinese food, but Christ, do we have so much to look forward to. We've got King's new book, The Institute, to read, Creepshow on September 26th, another trip back to Castle Rock in October, and yes, our highly anticipated return to the Overlook Hotel with Dr. Sleep in November. Look, nobody said it was easy being a constant listener. It's actually a little exhausting. That's why we're so fortunate to have you around and why we want to hear from you. So please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and stay connected with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Goodreads. After all, these are busy times and we'd be wise to stick together as we continue our journey through long days and pleasant nights. I got some hot friends.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM podcast network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.